Welcome to the Happy Hippie Podcast, your weekly dose of holistic wellness and positive energy. I'm your host, Amanda McCormack. I'm here to guide you on a journey to a happier, more fulfilled life. As a certified yoga teacher, personal trainer, nutrition coach, and a women's wellness specialist, I'm very passionate about helping you transform your life, mind, body, and soul. Whether you're into fitness, nutrition, or you're just seeking more joy in your daily routine, you have come to the right place. Each week, we'll explore practical tips, share inspiring conversations, and discover new ways to embrace happiness in every aspect of your life. We'll dive into healthy habits, mindful practices, and simple strategies that can help you create lasting positive change. So get comfortable, take a big breath, and let's begin this journey together. This is the Happy Hippie Podcast, where wellness meets happiness, and transformation begins with you. Hello, and welcome to another episode. I am thrilled to introduce you to our amazing guest today, Gigi Langer. Gigi is an incredible author, a speaker, and an expert in helping people overcome anxiety and negative thinking patterns to live a happier, less stressful life. Couldn't think of somebody more aligned with the show. With 37 years of sobriety and a PhD from Stanford University in psychological studies and education, Gigi brings both a personal experience and an academic like expertise to her work. She's the author of two transformative books, 50 Ways to Worry Less Now and Love More Now, Facing Life's Challenges with an Open Heart. Today's episode, we are going to dive deep into powerful techniques for calming your mind, developing self-compassion, staying present, and overcoming what Gigi calls whispered lies, which are those limiting beliefs that hold us back. Formerly known as the Queen of Worry, Gigi shares her journey from being a prisoner of her own anxieties to helping thousands of people improve their lives through her books, speeches, retreats, and workshops. So I'm very excited for this episode. I feel like you will get a lot out of it. I'm especially excited because Gigi is offering something exclusive to our listeners. So stay tuned to the end of the episode to learn out how you can receive a free copy of one of her amazing books. I'm so excited that's happening. So tune in for that. And I've personally found so many aha moments while reading her work. I know you're going to find tremendous value in our conversation today. So let's dive right into the interview. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here, Amanda.
Yes. I guess the first thing I wanted to ask was, could you share like a little bit about yourself and a little bit about your journey from being, like you called it, a prisoner of your worries to somebody that actually helps other people with their stress and anxieties?
Sure. Yeah. By the time I was 36, maybe 37, I was in my third marriage, divorced twice. I was kind of a romance addict. You know, I could get that romantic high to last for 3 or 4 years and then I'd leave. And so that's why so many relationships. And then, you know, I had a really good job. I was in my third marriage. I thought it was fine. And during grad school, I mean, what was I doing at Stanford with all these smart people, right? Doing a doctorate. Because part of me thought if I didn't achieve well, I was nothing. And that had been driving me. So the anxiety I had with that was huge. So I found a bar to go to every night. And I found a guy to live with who grew his own marijuana. So basically, the way I handled the stress was, you know, to get high every night and weekend. But I still got the job done, you know. So I finished. And then I met the guy that I went to Michigan with. And that was the third husband. And by the time... Oh, maybe I always married fast, right? So I fell in love fast, married fast. Within a year, I was, you know, kind of sneaking marijuana and over drinking and starting to fool around on him. He traveled a lot. And I thought, what in the hell? You know, I was doing things I would never do sober. And so I went to a psychologist and I said, you know, I got this brand new PhD and this good job and the seedy little private secret life that I feel awful about. And he got my family history and he said, well, you know, your dad was a high functioning alcoholic. Your mother was allergic to it. She really couldn't drink without getting violently ill. You're in the early stages of alcoholism. And I thought, knock me over with a feather, you know, but early stages, you know, well, it can't be so bad. So he said, well, you know, if you really want to know if you have a problem, I'm not going to be the one to tell you, but why don't you try having two drinks, no more, no less, and see what happens. And so for the next 6 months, I mean, thank God I lived through it, but sometimes I could have two drinks and stop, which led me to believe I can't be an alcoholic, right? Because if you people can't stop. But other times I would have two drinks, third drink, fourth drink, find the man, find the marijuana, go, you know, drive drunk. And, you know, to the extent of taking off my wedding ring. And, you know, I mean, it was. And finally, I realized, gosh, I can't predict if I have one or two drinks, what I'm going to do next. I may stop or I may do really stupid stuff and really scary stuff and really dangerous stuff. So I was seeing him that whole time and he was never pushing me to quit. But he said, you know, if you really feel like that's the truth for you, you should consider going to a 12-step program. And I thought, to me, but I did go because I was so miserable. I mean, you know, I couldn't. I grew up thinking you had to have, you know, the white picket fence and the two children and everything would be perfect once you fell in love and all the fairy tales. And it wasn't working and it wasn't working and it wasn't working. And I knew something was wrong, but I didn't. I thought, well, you know, maybe that's it. So that was when I quit drinking and using marijuana or any other mind-altering drugs, including things like Xanax and other benzos. So I haven't had a drink since, which I'm very grateful for. It's been over 30 years.
Amazing.
I did have that third divorce. After a year, I didn't run away like I usually did, you know, with we went to couples therapy. I stayed. So, you know, I did it the mature way, which was the first time I'd ever done that in any relationship. And then about a year later, I was at a 12-step meeting and I met Peter and we've been married for over, well, after 2.5 years, because I did not trust myself. We've been married for 30 plus years. And, you know, I didn't fall in love for the first year of sobriety. I stayed out of relationships, what they suggest, because it is an addiction of sorts. And anyway, so that's, you know, I've been very, very happy. What caused me to write a book about how to worry less now is, you know, I was awake, right? I wasn't dulling my emotions with drugs, alcohol, sex, shopping, whatever people use to do that. And that's a hard place to be when you've got all this shit going around in your head. Yeah. And in the 12 steps, you look at the shit that's going around in your head and you own it. And you take responsibility for the fact that you don't have to believe everything your mind is telling you. And so the theme of the book is whispered lies, because that is what I grew up with. You know, my dad would say, I was the youngest of four. He would say, Gigi, how can you be so goddamn dumb? You know, so who has a million degrees, right? You know, And, you know, because that was the way in my family, I felt like I could get some attention and feeling good about myself. But that became, like, when you hang your whole self-esteem on some one thing that only the world can deliver, you're screwed, right? Because we have no control over that stuff.
Exactly.
So I think when we commit to emotional growth and to being healthy in our relationships and with our own body, we start getting some wake-up calls, and they're not always comfortable. So the first thing that happened to me was I hurt my back and I had to lie on my back for 2 weeks straight and I was in chronic pain. I had been a jock. I had ridden horses and done all, and now I was laid flat, you know, and I wasn't even 40 yet. And that, you know, was very humbling. I couldn't control it. I couldn't control the pain. I went to many people, but eventually, you know, I ran it. People would say, well, have you listened to Pema Chodron? She talks about pain and she's a Buddhist nun and she's wickedly funny. And Someone gave me her CD, and it was like, I thought I was the only person in the world who was suffering this way. It was all about me. And she said, well, what about having compassion for other people who are suffering in the same way? Not to deny my own feelings, but to join with others rather than isolate and crunch in on myself. Well, that's kind of a subtle point, but I was so self-centered. And that's basically what I think emotional growth boils down to, is becoming less self-centered. And I mean, there's a point for self-care, and we'll talk about that, right? But when my self-centeredness causes me to try to control things and manipulate or resist, how could this be happening to me? And so after the, that got me a little more humble to admit that, my body was not the end all and be all, right? It was going to fail me sometimes. Then I got two frozen shoulders for 2 years, couldn't drive my car. I mean, couldn't do my hair. Then, I had a major surgery. So the w reason I wrote the book is because there were like seven or eight of these challenges that, because it got my nose in the dirt, right? I couldn't change these things. I couldn't control them. My own anxiety at work, I couldn't change it of my own free will. I was a victim to it. I was insanely jealous, perfectionistic. Well, it was humbling, right? Because I was still going to a 12-step program. I was trying to establish some kind of a higher power or a true self that I could connect with as a source of wisdom rather than my own intellect, which I thought was going to save me, but it never did.
Yeah, we all do. That's like
So basically, I learned just a bunch of techniques to connect with my true self rather than listening to my fearful self.
Oh, thank you for sharing. I especially the fact that you mentioned the Buddhist nun. I remember reading that part, and I really love in the book that there's so many modalities that you draw from. Like, it's not just from the psychology lens. You pull in philosophy, you pull in things from like Buddhist teaching, the Tao. There's so many things that it's so nice to learn it too. But I also respect and really love that it's in the title. You also give tools, 50 ways. Like, every other page, or mostly every page, has like an actionable technique. So not only can you learn about this information and like see it in front of you, but you made it able so we can digest each bit and turn it into your everyday life. So I think it was fantastic to go through that and be like, wow, you can actually take these concepts and every day work at it like in a little way, you know?
Thank you. I am a former teacher. I taught Spanish and French in middle school, and then after I finished my graduate work, I taught future teachers. So I'm a big fan of practical, concrete. It's so frustrating to read a self-help book and you hear all these wonderful miracles that happen. They never draw the curtain back and show you the hard work they
Exactly.
did.
Yeah. What was maybe like your first or second experience using these tools in your life, and you were like, wow, these are really working, and I want to like share them with other people?
Well, in a 12-step program, you're constantly sharing ways of thinking about other people, relationships, your own being, some quasi-spiritual ideas if you are attracted to those, but you don't have to be. So that was kind of a natural thing, but to share them with the general public, it happened when I had retired. I'd been at that university preparing teachers for several years and finally retired. And I was on a plane coming back from seeing my mother. And she was pretty much disabled at that point, but her mind was totally there. And we had had such a nice time. I did not need anything from her. She was, she was so codependent with my father and his alcoholism, and I was the youngest of four. So she didn't really have time or space in her heart, so to speak, for me or to show that. So then I grabbed on to other things, grades, men, et cetera, to in that time with her, because I had been doing a lot of again, techniques to connect with an open heart rather than a condemning, jealous, angry, abandoned heart, you know, that I, on that plane, I realized, my God, I have no hard feelings toward my mother or my father. And this is quite the miracle, because you talk to people all the time that are, you know, uncovering stuff. And I had gone through periods where I had to deal with the anger toward my father and the anger toward my mother and so on. So it's not like it happened without any help on my part. But the miracle was I truly felt an open heart toward her. And I thought, boy, I've been doing all these different things these years, basically to open my heart, right? To love, rather than being ruled by fear and resentment. And I thought, wouldn't it be great? You know, I had been doing it through the 12 steps, but also a lot of therapy, a lot of studying other way, energy work, you know, the tapping. I mean, lots. So I thought, wouldn't it be neat to share these with other people? Because a lot of people don't go to 12-step programs, and yet these tools are pretty universal. So then I just wrote down, you know, like if I could compress the 12 steps into the most useful way. You know, I came up with those four life strategies, right? You got to be honest. I mean, if you're numbing yourself with romance, work, drugs, alcohol, whatever, you're not going to grow spiritually or emotionally, or your heart is going to remain kind of covered up to you and other people. It won't function as a love mechanism, right? So we got to be honest about the fact that I'm responsible for the kinds of relationships I have. And so that's the honesty. And maybe I've been doing some things that really aren't helpful, you know. I couldn't help but write the book without putting in the second part, which is the power, that it's a power beyond my intellect, okay? And for years, I thought my intellect was my savior. If I can analyze this, I can figure it out. But you might have heard the word analysis paralysis.
Exactly,
where we just analyze and and there is a part of, yes, there is a part of each of us, you know, regardless of where we find it, in our own self, in our true self, or out there in some spiritual thing, whatever, it is wiser than just this intellect. So that's why I had to put the second thing, is you got to surrender using your intellect for everything and be willing to open yourself to some other modes and ways of receiving wisdom. And then I saw you had a recent podcast on the power of positive thinking.
Yes.
I couldn't help but put the third step, choice, that I need to choose how I want my future to be. I can't just be floating along, you know? I mean, but I'm not going to get too specific, because I want to leave a little space for that magic. So I'm not going to say a red car 1996 Corvette, you know. But I did put a little post-it before I met my current husband on my mirror, thank you for a happy, healthy marriage. And that was when I was facing my third divorce, right? So those affirmations, visualization, you know, all the successful athletes use it. It's very powerful. And then finally, you got to work your ass off with tools, because this brain is constantly feeding us BS, you know, based on years of conditioning. So I came up with that, and then I put up these big strips of paper and I said, you know, which thing happened to me that caused me to discover this thing? And I just tried to fit them in there. And eventually I wrote my first draft and wrote the second draft and the third draft, the whole draft.
Oh, I love hearing about that process, though. It's because it's like walking around with all these thoughts all the time. It's almost like why journaling is such a great practice to have.
Yes.
Is like you can get these things out and see them. But it's cool to see how you conceptualize everything into those steps, and it does flow. Like you were just saying,
oh, thank
as well.
You.
Yeah, the like the act of almost like surrendering, when you were talking about non-attachment, having that step before where you have a higher power or whatever you'd like to call it, helps you lean into the idea that I can release this. I don't have to like grip onto it, or this is who I am and this is my identity. Like having that knowing, it's almost like you can unknown. Like, you can trust, you can let things go, and you can move on. So it's beautiful how it does flow.
Thank you. Thank you. I do believe it was, I meditated every time before I went to my writing desk and asked, you know, but I didn't come up with the idea myself. It dawned on me on that airplane. And then I was going to write a memoir. And I started, and my husband said, you know, I hear you talking to the people you sponsor in 12-step programs all the time on the phone. Why don't you put that stuff in the book?
That was like a message coming in another way.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. And I was running up the stairs to my office to write. I never felt like, oh, God, I have to do this. You know, so clearly it was meant to be.
Oh, no, it's lovely. And I think one concept that I would love if you can maybe break it down for some listeners was what you mentioned earlier, too, the concept of whispered lies, which in a way is kind of like our negative self-talk, maybe. Could you explain like what this is and how somebody can recognize what their whispered lies are?
Sure. Just listen to your thinking.
True.
You know, I think a lot of people call it the inner critic. People in 12-step programs call it the committee that's always so helpful in our brain. But basically, if you grew up in a home where for some reason, you know, somebody in the home was dysfunctioning, disabled, there was a horrible divorce, you know, something interfered with your parents' ability to give you attention and affirmation and care to the extent that you wanted, okay? And everybody wants more than what they get, right?
Yeah.
But you kind of grow up with this whispered lie, I'm not worthy of love, which, you know, maybe that's the existential lie that everyone has. I don't know. But definitely if you're from a family like that, or sometimes you learn that in abusive relationships early in your life where someone you put on a pedestal keeps tearing you down and you start believing those lies. So it's basically like this house of cards we build. If I'm going to be lovable, I have to do X. Okay. So for me, first it was to get good grades. It's my first grade teacher, you know, I learned to read early and da da da. So boy, I could get some good kudos in my family for getting good grades, you know. So interestingly, I went on for all those degrees, you know, kind of driven by that whispered lie. The smarter I am, the more people will pay attention to me and think I'm okay. It's a lie because it's not true. It helped me. It was a survival strategy, okay? So those lies are made up by our desperate self to find some way to fit in, to be okay. So, you know, a lot of us have the one, I have to be in a romantic, loving relationship that lasts forever, and the romance never wears off, and I'll be forever happy, and there's never supposed to be any conflict, you know, from all. So these are whispered lies because they don't align with truth, and they also don't align with the fact that, and this is what I ultimately came to, my worth is established by my higher power, my true self, my wise self, my some part of me that is not my intellect and is not my body. It's a good part of me that's always been there. Way, you know, that divine spark that we have. And the beauty of 12-step programs is when I walked in there, those people could see it. Those women could see the light in me. And I had no light that I was aware of. I was, you know, you can't be loved if you don't, you know, you don't have a man who's constantly adoring you. You can't be happy if you don't get these great grades. You have to have people like you. You have to look good to be accepted. At some point, our survival strategies turn around on us and start hurting us.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the moment of awakening, but it's a hell of an awareness, right?
Yeah.
And that's why I don't suggest that people try to do a lot of this work completely on their own. We need at least one other guiding light that we meet with regularly, a person, a therapist, or whatever, a group, where people are farther down the line. And they can see the possibility in me, and I can see the possibility in them of not being imprisoned by this self-centered fear.
Yeah.
And that it will allow me to open my heart up to be able to give love and receive love with no agenda. Because I always had an agenda, right? Manipulate.
Yep.
When I did my first inventory, you know, they use inventories. What is my part in the crash and burn of my last marriage? And I looked at what my part was. I was pretending the entire time. I was pretending to be the person they wanted me to be. They had no chance of making me happy because I never told them what I needed, because I never even knew myself. The only thing I knew to do was to pretend to be romantically in love and to be and to idolize them. And so that was manipulative. That was completely selfish on my part. And I had always blamed the men. You know, they didn't give me enough attention. They didn't. No. It was on me. My love mechanism was broken.
But as women, too, I feel like in just growing up as a child or even like a teen, we're surrounded with like so much media and everything we consume. And even the stories that come passed down from like parents and their parents and all these things, it's sometimes we're told like, we need to feel like we have to look a certain way, or our value is like if we find a man or this and that. So I feel like we've learned this from such a young age. Like we are unlearning a lot of like hard wiring stuff that was developed even at like 11. I remember watching like certain Disney movies and things and taking in these ideas. And like I went to an all girls high school. I didn't even have like my first interaction with boys until I was in college, and I didn't know what to do. Once I was there, because I had all this stuff that I watched in movies and TV shows and like books I was reading, like they told me who I had to be almost, or like, and that's where I feel like a lot of my wiring came from too. But I feel as women, we have a lot of that put on us.
Yes. And I'm glad that you're using the word wiring, because everything that I mentioned in my book, especially this idea of reprogramming our thinking, I put a little paragraph of research in there because, well, first I was trained to be a researcher, but also somebody said, well, why should I believe that this technique's going to work? Mm. Where's the beef? Where's the research? So this guy, Joe Dispenza, is a big proponent of that you can rewire. And that's why a simple tool, just like a gratitude list. Everybody's heard of gratitude lists, right? You write down 5 things a day at the end of the day, or you think of them. The way to really, and that starts to reprogram a little bit because you're forcing your mind to think of something positive rather than negative. The other thing that can really amp it up is to not repeat anything that you had the day before.
Try to find something different.
So that way, as he explains it, all day you're looking for something you can add to your gratitude list because that's not on there already. So your brain already is starting to look for good stuff. Rewiring.
Exactly. Especially if like we're wired to look for bad stuff. Like I know, which I feel is very common. When you come home from like the end of your day, it's so easy to talk about your complaints and what went wrong before you talk about what went right. Sometimes it comes too naturally, I think, from society and yes, like our background, but it's just so funny. I'll find myself like, if my mom calls me, I'm like, well, this happened. And then I have to like catch myself and be like, there were wonderful things that happened in my day, but we have to just train ourselves to see it. And we can, like you said, we can totally, our brain, we can do that, like neuroplasticity. We can totally rewire different parts. Like it can take time. We have to be consistent, but we can, which is very wonderful.
It really is. I mean, my first therapist that talked to me about alcoholism was into cognitive therapy. And even in the 80s, there was the book, Feel Good. And it was about basically the wrong stuff you allow your brain to tell you and believe, and replacing it with right stuff that you want to believe. And that's probably more true. There are so many techniques in the book, but this one, and I can't explain it fully here, but the one with the turnarounds, The Work by Byron Katie, where I put a whole example at the end of the book, because I went through 2 or 3 days of training with her to watch her do it over and over again. But the point is that you turn around a thought. So when this is what I put in the book, when my beloved business partner, we did workshops together with teachers, had cancer, she started working, you know, she kept working really hard. And I became kind of codependent, like, she shouldn't be working this hard, right? Mm-hmm. Whenever there's should in a statement, we know there's some kind of whispered lie.
Operating. Yeah, that's so true, the should.
And, you know, so in Byron Katie's thing, she says, well, is that 100% true that she should not be working? Yes, that's true. She had cancer. She needs to rest. Well, is it really true? I said, well, I suppose it's true. And then she said, well, turn it around. She should be working more. Instead of she should not be working more, say she should be working more. Now ask yourself, is that as true or truer? And as I played around with it, I thought, you know, she loves her work. She's passionate about it. She's probably terrified that she's not going to live as long as she wants. Maybe she's working so hard because she loves it.
Yeah.
So who am I to say she should not?
Yeah.
That's such a powerful strategy.
It takes you outside of the narrative that you create. Like, you have almost like a formula that we're going through all the time, and it pulls you out for a second, and you're like, wait.
Exactly.
You're seeing it from another point of view.
Yes. Oh. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like you mentioned with the journaling, you know, that gets it out on the page. You can see it. It's very powerful for people who like to journal. Not everybody does. Mm.
Which is good, because then you have 49 other techniques in your book you can pick from. There's other options. But kind of circling back on that topic, like, a lot of the times, especially even my journey, I find stepping back from whatever it is, whether I'm working on complaining less or I'm working on being kinder to myself or noticing my thoughts, it's about having that awareness where you take a moment to pause and like step back. And you did explain, you explained a few things, but one of the ones I really liked was the golden mind. You had like a theory where you can you explain a little bit about that? Because when I saw that, I was like, I really want to integrate this into my routine, because it was a really aha moment.
Was it the golden key
golden
where you're
key.
Working?
Yeah.
Good. So here's the great news. We have complete control over what our mind dwells on. Now, I can't pick what it dwells on first, okay? It's like a dog. It's going to dwell, you know. However, I can learn to watch it and notice what it's dwelling on. And then I can say, are these thoughts scaring me or making me tense or mean? And do I want to stay with them? And then I change them. So it's like thought switching is the generic term. So here's the thing. It's not a one and done. My mind will return to its wired way of thinking. So if I'm thinking, like, I'm doing a talk at our local golf community this Monday. And about a week ago, when I was doing the slides, I had a big wrestling match with my fearful self, my ego, because, oh, you're going to see these people around. They're going to think, oh, she thought she was so smart. And, you know, they're going to judge me, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I had to wait a while before I noticed that those thoughts were really making me tense. Because I think if we're had a lifelong of worry, we're so in it's our natural state of being, right? So
yeah.
It, like, we don't notice it. until we get tense. So part of growing emotionally is letting our body tell us when we're scaring ourselves with our thinking. Anyway, so I noticed that I was doing a lot of fearful thinking, and I used the golden key. And the golden key is, well, the way it was originally taught by Emmett Fox, who wrote a wonderful book called The Sermon on the Mount, which is not super Christian. He's a great author. I highly recommend him about changing your thinking. In his original version, he has you think about, you notice you're thinking about, oh God, that workshop's not going to be good enough. And then he says, you just notice that and switch your thinking to, in his case, God, higher power. And I think he has you actually think of characteristics of God, you know, goodness, wisdom, whatever. In the more generic model that I shared, you can think about anything positive. So what I replaced the fear thought with was, I will be inspired to share what's best for everyone there. And as I switched again and again, like 20 times in a minute, you know, to that one, I all of a sudden it dawned on me, oh my God, this isn't about me. It's about them. I can connect with them, with their hearts, my heart, with my heart. I don't have to let the fear thoughts drive the bus. I can notice them and change them. And I talked with my sponsor about it. I prayed about it. I wrote about, you know, it's not like one technique is going to totally switch off a recurring whispered lie, which is, if I'm not perfect, nobody's going to like me, right? Same old, same old.
Yeah.
And it's okay. That's where self-compassion comes in. I kind of pat myself on the back and say, you know, when you're facing a challenge, you always get scared shitless. It's okay. It's okay. You were led to take this on. It's going to be fine. What tools can we use to change our thoughts? And that reconnects me with, yeah.
I love that. It's like a physical tool that you can use. Like, you can understand the concept of, okay, I am having these thoughts and maybe I have to pull away. But when it's happening, it's hard to do that. So I think the physical tools that you create are so nice because you can apply them and you can have, and like you said, it could work for one person. And then there's other ones that you can try because everyone's going to be different. But having something that, you know, in your like little toolbox in the back of your mind, it's so nice to be able to just like reach in and be like, whoop.
Yeah. Yes. And people replace that scary thought with many kinds of things. You know, people who have a religion or a spiritual belief do an affirmation, you know, all is well, thank you, God, for this. They say the serenity prayer instead. You know, just our mind is like a dog. If you put the shiny toy in front of it of a positive thought, it orients to the positive thought, you know. And then it goes back and then you redirect it again. And I wanted to mention that you said in the morning in your routine, you do meditation. And I can't tell you how many people say to me, I can't meditate. I can't empty my mind. It's impossible for me. I'm just a person who can't meditate. Well, if you think about what we were just talking about, that you can observe your thinking in order to have the choice to change it. Where do you learn to observe your thinking? So the way I think about and I use guided meditations. I don't, you know, I like having, you know, a little tool like Insight Timer, guided meditation on hope, or if I'm sad or grieving, you know, on grieving. They have topics on there, on the free one. So anyway, and I can send you some of my favorite people on there. You probably have people you've recommended too. But
definitely. I love to find.
So what the essence of meditation is not emptying your mind. Yes. It is getting still enough. You can use breathing, whatever, but you choose a focus. So most people put you on breathing, right? You can feel your belly going in and out. You can feel the nose. So there's a focus that's not worrying, right? But of course, our mind goes back to worrying. You do not beat yourself up for the fact that your mind went back to worrying. you just say, oh, look at that. I'm worrying. I'm going to consciously bring my mind back to breathing.
Yes, no
So
judgment.
people say, well, God, I had in 1 minute, I had to bring my mind back 20 times. I said, that's great. You got more practice.
Yeah, right. You did more laps mentally.
Yes, exactly. So that for me is like the mega anti-worry tool, is to be able to get still. And when you mentioned pausing, there's a saying, pause, pause, action. P-A-U, until S, serenity, emerges.
Oh, so nice.
So we will never be able to deal with a conflict or a fear out of a scrambled, worried mind. We won't get the best guidance. We owe it to ourselves to learn how to calm down and access this wisdom that's inside of us or outside, however we think of it, during that pause time. And the pause may be a week or two if it's a thorny relationship with someone, where it takes a while to work through the resentments. And I think most people don't think worry has to do with resentment. But really, if you think that something went wrong, there was a little conflict, okay? And we're social beings. We hate having a rift with another human being that we love, that we care about. That's like one of the most painful human experiences. And so we start thinking, if I had said this, if they hadn't said that.
Yep.
Or what if I say this? If I call them right now and say this, it'll fix it, right? If I do this, that's all action born out of fear, right? I can't stand this feeling of having a rupture in my relationship with so-and-so. I have to act to try to make it better. But no. Those actions won't come from the best part of ourselves. So we need to go back into connecting and using all the tools we can with connecting with our true self, our wise self, until, and one of the, I wrote a second book, by the way, that came out a year ago. It's called Love More Now. And it deals much more deeply with resentments and relationship issues. And this one example was a sister who was taking care of their elderly mother. And she had another sister who was not pulling her weight. And the one caregiver was getting pissed off and exhausted and, you know, overwhelmed. And she was angry at her sister, and they'd had bad words. And so they were, you know, so she's trying to think, is there something I can say or do to fix it? No, because that's all external. The fixing it comes here. So she, you know, she was aware enough to know that she had some responsibility for the difficulty. And then when we do that and we open ourselves to just a different source of input other than our worry, hating mind, we get little miracles coming in. So in this case, some friends invited her to a meditation group. She decided to go, you know. Well, she got into some personal growth things, met with a counselor. So she did some specific things. Instead of every time thinking of her sister, thinking of what she hated about her, she thought about her strengths. She saw every strength that she could whenever she thought about her sister. She prayed for her sister, that her sister get everything that would make her happy, even though that was the hardest thing in the world for her to do because her hating mind wanted to keep hating. But nothing comes from hate.
Exactly.
She eventually started looking at her own part. She was the oldest in her family. She had grown up with the whispered lie, in order to be important and competent, I have to take care of everybody else but me. So she had the caregiver overdoing. And she worked on that it was her whispered lie that was because she was actually pissed off about always having been the caregiver.
Yeah, it's coming from
But,
inside.
you know, until it doesn't work, I mean, she was having chronic pain. She was having anxiety. You know, she was getting a lot of consequences from wrapping herself up in hatred and resentment. And she worked through that. She realized, why am I the only one who can be the best caregiver? You know, she worked through that with therapy and some help. You know, I think these more deep-seated things like caretaking, people-pleasing, where we put another person ahead of our self-care, perfectionism, which I had big time, workaholism, or overdoing. These are things that ruin relationships because we think that we're going to feel okay if we do them, but we don't care about the other person, right?
It's self-motivated.
Anyway,
really.
You know, it resolved it. And in this second book, Love More Now, I go into all those different patterns and some inventories that can help people overcome those very, I call them more core whispered lies. Mm. You know, they're deep.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. So they go hand in hand? You would suggest reading one book and then the other, or?
Yeah, the second one is Facing Life's Challenges with an Open Heart. It's called, you know, the first one's Worry Less Now, 50 Ways. And the second one is Love More Now. So, you know, our goal here, I believe, is to be a source of loving care to ourselves and others whenever possible, to work toward that. To forgive ourselves when we fail. I use a lot of self-compassion, and I can give you that reference that I love for Kristen Neff, the self-compassion meditations. I'm human, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to blow it. It's okay. Now, what can we do?
Say a lot of our listeners, when I sometimes get responses, when I reach out saying, like, what do you want to hear more about, or what are things that you're interested in? Self-compassion is number one or number two. I'd say becoming present and focusing on ways to be more present instead of like very future and past oriented comes up a lot. And then the other thing that comes up is being very harsh on the self. So those are things that I know a lot of women who listen to the show come up with. So.
The self-compassion. I saw a cute little cartoon that I put on Facebook. It was, talk to yourself like you talk to your favorite doggy or cat. Aren't you cute? Look at that cute little tummy. Isn't that the cutest idea?
Wait, that is really great, though. That's like a really nice reframing.
Yeah. And one day, as I'm a cat person, I was cuddling my kitty and I was looking at her so with such adoring love. And I asked myself, I wonder if my higher power feels that way toward me.
Oh.
Because I think love can be streamed through other people in healthy ways that are accepting and loving and caring and non-judging and non-manipulative. So sometimes we can't access this airy-fairy higher power thing or our true self, you know, but other people can kind of stream it toward us. And eventually we learn to stream it for ourselves. Hmm. And that's what a lot of those techniques are, because my belief is the more of the loving thoughts and care and self-compassion we stream into ourselves, it dissolves the worries and the impediments and the whispered lies that are blocking our heart from being open to others. So the self-compassion, and staying in the moment. I learned this, well, I had it in my toolbox, but I hadn't ever had to use it as desperately as I had to use it this time. There's a person in my family's life, it's not a relative, whom often gets abusive to their partner. And one time I was visiting and he was right in my face when I was insisting on being able to call my husband for advice on an issue that had arisen with my car. You know, why do you have to do it? Why do you have to right in my face? I mean, it was really scary. And I totally reverted. And I finally said, well, F you. And I walked away. Those words came from the terrified little child that had observe my parents throwing things across the room and all kinds of stuff. So I went into the bathroom. My heart's pounding. I'm in total fight, flight, freeze mode. And I used this five little things. I said, okay, how can I settle myself down? Thank God I could even think of this. But five things I'm feeling right now in my body. Oh, my heart's pounding. I'm breathing hard. My head hurts. My stomach hurts. And then five of those. Then four things that I can hear. Okay, I hear the birds tweeting. I hear this toilet rumbling. I hear someone closing a door. I hear a jet going over. Then, three things that I can see. Well, I see the door, the handle, blah, blah. Two things that I can taste. And then one thing that is a strength of mine. And well, I was strong enough to remember to do something to help myself through this. And I did settle down. I made the mistake of going out and trying to make the amends before I had processed it all wrong. And that I just walked away, didn't make it worse. But I had settled myself down and gotten to a place. And then I did a lot of work before I was with that person before. I have a door I can walk out of if I have to. I'm not going to be alone in a room with it. I set up my own self-protection so that I wouldn't feel that way again.
That's real. I really like that technique too. I feel like it's the same thing. If you know you have it, you can step back, pull it out, and use it when those emotions come up or when you're feeling these things. Oh, that's so
Exactly.
nice.
And I don't think we should punish our should. I don't think we need to punish ourselves when we regress, when we go back to a fear mode, when we spent a half hour, quote, obsessing about the bad haircut I just got. I just did that. It's sort of like self-compassion. Okay, we hate that when it happens. Okay, it's okay. Let's try to shift our mind a little bit, And we didn't talk about energy healing, which is a whole different animal. The tapping, which is much more in the popular awareness now. The tapping solutions. It's a way of bringing myself down because the body is the one that's traumatized. So sometimes just self-talk doesn't help, but when you tap into these energy modalities, and there's some formulas they use that are real complicated, but the simple thing is, even though I'm terrified that this is like mom and dad are throwing things across the room, I love and accept myself completely, and God loves and accepts me completely, and all is well, and then I'll do it over and over again until it's gone down some. And it,
There's so many tools. So I'm like, I
isn't
could
it
be
great?
forever. But it's wonderful because same thing, different people may be more attracted to try one thing or another area,
Exactly.
but all of them with consistency, like over time.
Exactly. And we are not stuck. We have control over what our minds dwell on. And if we say, oh, my feelings are driving the bus, no, your thoughts are driving your feelings. If you really look, feelings are not facts. They have something behind them that's fear-based.
Is there anything else that you'd like to share or we didn't get to with the audience or anything that's on your mind?
I want to say if you feel stuck, try to reach out to one other person who's healthy emotionally and has been where you are before. So if you reach out to a friend who's just going to co-sign your panic and resentment, that's not going to be helpful. So when they say talk about it, they're not talking about continuing the same rut. They're talking about talking with someone who has been there but knows some ways out and knows that you can find ways out. So you can.
Yay. Thank you for sharing that. And your book also gives a lot of really good resources on how to find different groups of people or different places where you can find these people, because I think it is important to find like a tribe, kind of like a group of people that you can have this if you don't have it like at your disposal.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Cool.
And where can our listeners find you or learn more about your work?
Sure. I have a website, GGGIGI, Langer, LANGER.com. So it's just my name. And on there, you can get the books. You can, and because we're doing this podcast, when you post this, we can give my email, or maybe now I'll give it glanger2202@gmail.com. But I will send a free book to your listeners.
Oh, wow.
If they email you or me, because my printer printed an extra run of these.
Oh,
because they had
amazing.
Made a mistake. So I don't mind at all shipping it to people who request it.
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Thank you for doing that for the listeners.
Yeah. And the second book is on Amazon. Mm. They're under G.G. Langer, you know, and it's only $10. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
I'll link also in the description of this episode, wherever you guys are listening. I'll put all the links and all the places that you can reach Gigi. So if you visually want to check it out, it'll be right below this episode. So feel free to check that. And yeah, you know what? One question I always do ask for fun with anybody I interview is, are you reading anything good recently, or have you read anything, whether it's fiction or nonfiction? Do you have any book recommendations? Because we're bookies here.
I am a huge book reader, and recently, usually I don't do audiobooks, but recently someone told me that Meryl Streep, who is prima best actress, narrated the book by Ann Patchett, who's one of my favorite authors, called Tom Lake. Mm-hmm. And it is absolutely wonderful. It's set in Michigan. It has some people involved in theater, and they're picking cherries, and it's during the pandemic, and she has daughters, and it's totally uplifting and fascinating. So it's Tom Lake by Ann Patchett.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to read too, but really good.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for sharing. I love getting book recommendations, and I'm sure everyone else does too.
Yes.
Well, thank you again for taking the time to come on the show. We really appreciate it, and for sharing all your wisdom. And I hope everyone listening gets something out of this episode. You can find Gigi and her links below, and feel free to message us or email with any questions or anything.
Thanks, Amanda.
Thanks.